UXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back long before you or me, millions of years, to the formation of some of the structural bones of our universe. Now, we're still learning what dwarf galaxies are, but a team of scientists is challenging the more widely accepted model, and this is no small matter. It's about understanding the evolution of our universe. Later this hour, we're going to spend time exploring the ways we might soon be able to look deeper into space or more accurately into the cosmos. Don Figer, the director of RIT's Center for Detectors, is here in studio. We're eager to talk to him about that and more. And we're joined now by David Merritt, professor of physics and astronomy in RIT's College of Science. He's also the co-author of the paper that challenges, I think it's fair to say, challenges the establishment view of dwarf galaxies, David. And that's probably fair, right?
I think that's fair, yes.
Okay. And thank you, by the way, for being here and for sharing your expertise. And before we can better understand the implications of what you and the team are saying about dwarf galaxies, we should probably start with some basic definitional model of what the universe is, and that'll help us understand how what you're saying sort of contrasts to what we've been hearing for a long time. So I think we should start with some definitions or how you would want us to at least understand the basic model of understanding our universe to begin with.
Sure, that's a good idea. So there's something called the Standard Model of Cosmology. It's called SMOC by some people, not by me. And it's based on certain observations, one of which is that we know the universe is expanding. We've known that for quite some time.
Yep.
And that's based on the fact that galaxies are moving away from us, and the farther the galaxies are, the faster they're moving. That's what you'd expect if, at some time, the universe was much smaller and it exploded in what's called the Big Bang. Obviously, matter that was expelled with a higher speed would be farther away from us now, and that's what you observe. So if you take this idea and combine it with Einstein's equations from relativity, which describe gravitation and how it interacts with matter, then you can compute or predict how the universe has evolved since the Big Bang. And this was first done sort of in the 1960s, and there were some real successes at that time. Let me mention two of them. One is it was believed then and still is believed now that the lighter elements in the universe, hydrogen, helium, lithium, were created during the Big Bang or shortly after, unlike the heavier elements, carbon, nitrogen, and so forth, that were made inside stars. And so combining the Standard Model of Cosmology with what we know of nuclear physics, nuclear interactions, you can compute what you would expect for the amounts of these light elements, and you get the right answer. And this was done in the 1960s. So that's one success. That's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Another big success was the prediction of the cosmic microwave background radiation. And here the idea is, again, thinking of the early universe as being very small and dense, it would also be very hot. In fact, at these early times, most of the energy was in radiation, photons, gamma rays, and things like that. And those photons should still be around, and you can compute that if we look around us now, we should still see them, but they should be much cooler. And it's basically a result of sort of adiabatic expansion, the same thing that makes, you know, gas cool when you spray it out of a spray bottle. The prediction is that those photons should be in the radio part of the spectrum, the microwave part of the spectrum. And that was confirmed, again, in the mid-1960s by observations at Bell Labs through the discovery of this radiation field that is all around us. So those successes gave astronomers great confidence in the Standard Model of Cosmology as it existed then. But some cracks began to appear roughly in the 1970s and 1980s. And let me mention a couple of those. First, there's what's called the galaxy rotation problem. And here's how that works. Stars like our sun, they're inside galaxies. Our sun's in the Milky Way, and it orbits around the center with about 200 kilometers per second of velocity. If you know that speed, and if you know how far a star like the sun is from the center of the galaxy, you can compute how massive the galaxy is. That's just a straightforward application of Newton's laws. The idea is that the orbit of the sun, it's being pulled around by gravity. Gravity must come from somewhere, and the obvious place is from the mass of the galaxy. If you do this, not just for the Milky Way, but for other galaxies, you find a discrepancy in every single case, and that is that far from the center of the galaxy, stars are moving much faster than they ought to be moving based on the gravitational force that's produced by the stars that you see in the galaxy. In fact, instead of the orbital velocity falling off with distance like it does in the solar system, Pluto goes much slower than the Earth around the sun. What you observe is that these stars at all radii farther and farther out from the center of a galaxy have the same velocity. It's almost exactly constant, and that's a very big surprise.
Instead of being slower, as we would expect.
That's right, okay. Yeah. When this was first discovered, I was in graduate school. It was called the missing mass problem because people asked, where is the matter producing the gravity which results in these high velocities? We don't see it. It's now called the dark matter problem. People nowadays assume that the matter is there. It's just in some invisible form. And the way it has to be distributed around galaxies is that most of it has to be far from the center. People call this the dark matter halo. And
you almost sound a little derisive about it, no?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be judgmental at this point.
Okay.
But it's a good point you're making, and I think, and that is that dark matter was an invention. There has never been any direct confirmation of its existence. In fact, early on it was realized that the dark matter, which would have to be most of the mass in the universe, which should far outweigh the matter that we see in stars, the dark matter couldn't be composed of normal matter, like neutrons, protons, electrons. And the reasons are kind of technical, but the main one is this Big Bang nucleosynthesis I mentioned earlier on. Mm-hmm. If you assume that there's a lot more matter than we see, then you get the wrong answer for the abundances of these light elements. It doesn't work. So whatever the dark matter is, it's some kind of particle that is outside of the standard model of particle physics. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It could. But it has to be some new type of particle that interacts very weakly with ordinary matter. Otherwise, we would directly detect it. So that was one of the problems. I'll just mention quickly two others, which probably people have heard about. The first is the horizon problem. And here the problem is that when astronomers look far out in the universe in one direction and then in some other direction, they see pretty much the same thing. For instance, this cosmic microwave background radiation is almost the same temperature no matter where you look. And that's hard to understand because it's easy to show that within the standard model, these very distant parts of the universe were never close enough together long enough to interact with each other and to reach an equilibrium. They ought to be rather different from each other, but in fact, they're very similar. And the way that was solved around 1980 was to invent another new thing called inflation. And it's, again, kind of technical, but mathematically, you can imagine that at very early times, the universe didn't follow Einstein's equations. Instead, it expanded much faster and for a very short time. And in the process, it evened itself out and became very homogeneous like we observe. But again, like dark matter, we don't really have a theory of inflation. There's no particle physicist that would say, oh, yes, inflation has to exist. It's just a postulate, which could be right, but may not be. And the third problem I'll mention was solved by the invention of dark energy. This problem became apparent in the 1990s, where the prediction of the standard model was that the universe is expanding, but the expansion should be slowing gradually with time because of all the gravitational force from all the matter in the universe should tug on galaxies and gradually slow them down. In fact, what was found is that the universe is accelerating. It's expanding faster. What seems to have happened is that about 5 billion years ago, the gradual deceleration changed to an acceleration, which is still going on. And that has, no obvious explanation in the standard model. So people invented another new thing, dark energy, which I think is fair to say is even more poorly understood than dark matter. I don't think physicists have a clue what it might be. But if it exists, it has some very strange properties, negative pressure and things like that. Again, very different from any sort of matter that's known.
All right. Before we get into what your team of scientists is now saying about dwarf galaxies and the implications there, you've outlined some of what we don't understand or poorly understand, and some of what you're talking about, dark matter and dark energy, two different things, but have been sort of created to fill in the gaps until we understand more. When you were going to school, dark matter wasn't part of the conversation, and now it is. But do you view it with skepticism more so than many of your colleagues?
I suppose that's a fair statement. One way to say this is that the reason that certain theories of science have such authority, or we have such confidence in them, is because they have made predictions which were then verified. So quantum mechanics, the theory of relativity, and so forth. These theories were very strange when they were first put out. They're still very strange. But people use them to predict what you ought to observe in the laboratory, in the universe. And when people went and looked, they confirmed those predictions. Some of them were very strange predictions, but they were confirmed. And whenever this happens, your confidence in the theory grows. With cosmology, that really hasn't happened. Since the 1960s, it has made prediction after prediction that was falsified. People went out and looked, and they found something different. And they responded by, as I said, imagining some new component which they put in. That doesn't mean these components don't exist. Dark matter may exist. But many people, I think, are uncomfortable by this. They'd rather that things are predicted before they're observed. And maybe that's too much to expect.
Well, and frankly, I mean, we're getting a little far afield here, but I can't help it. So if you're uncomfortable with the notion of dark matter, which helps fill in the gap of why stars are traveling more quickly than they should at certain points in their respective galaxies, then are you comfortable right now saying we don't know why, we don't need to fill in that gap with dark matter, or are you? Well, how would you position it?
I wouldn't say it that way. Let me first make another point, and that even though dark matter was sort of invented to solve this problem, it has other problems itself. And maybe the biggest one, to my way of thinking, is that people have been trying for decades now to directly detect the dark matter particles, and they failed again and again. And I think this is kind of a surprise. I think that when I was out of graduate school, people predicted that, you know, we would hope to directly observe a dark matter particle in the laboratory within a few years. Particle physicists are very clever. They build devices consisting of a big lump of some pure substance, which they hope will leave a track if a dark matter particle goes through it. And these have failed. So far, they've only ruled out dark matter particles. So I think that the reason for not believing in dark matter is becoming stronger over time as people continue to fail to detect it. But did I answer your question?
Well, yeah, I think you did. And so and we're going to be – we'll talk a little bit more about dark matter a little bit later in the hour, because I want to talk about things that I understand very, very poorly, like lux and a few other things that are designed – my understanding is to at least try to observe dark matter.
That's
correct,
yes.
But let's stop there for a second, and let's get back to it was in June that RIT sent out the alert about the paper that you helped co-author about dwarf galaxies. And so you've helped establish some of the problems here. What about dwarf galaxies and what is it that concerned – maybe concerned is the wrong word. What is it that the team observed when it comes to dwarf galaxies that might go against what the establishment has been saying?
Sure. So I should just define what a dwarf galaxy is.
Well, that's a good – let's do that, yes.
It's a small galaxy. Galaxies come in all sizes, and it's kind of an arbitrary distinction between a big galaxy and a dwarf. But for instance, the Milky Way, our galaxy – has long been known to have a sort of retinue of a couple dozen much smaller galaxies. The large and small Magellanic clouds are the two biggest of these. They're not visible from the northern hemisphere, but
they're dwarf galaxies.
They are, yeah, that's right. But there are also a number of much smaller ones that have been found.
And small being a relative term here, because we establish a dwarf galaxy exists within a larger galaxy.
That's
and
right.
The larger galaxy could have hundreds of billions of stars, and the dwarf galaxy a few billion?
Or less, that's right. So
okay.
It's sort of 1% or less the mass of the big galaxy would make it a dwarf galaxy.
It's not a small thing, it's just small relatively. Okay,
that's
so,
right.
So that's what a dwarf galaxy is.
And so when people within the sort of standard model of cosmology began doing simulations of how the universe evolves, they would put in the dark matter, obviously, in the simulations, and observe how it would do things gravitationally. One of the things that it does is it clusters. Lumps of dark matter get bigger because the gravity pulls in more dark matter around it. And this model makes definite predictions about how the dark matter should be clumped around a given big galaxy like the Milky Way. And one of the predictions is that a galaxy like the Milky Way should have hundreds, even thousands, of these dwarf galaxies around it. Now, the simulations typically only have dark matter in them, so it's kind of a leap to say, okay, I have a little clump of dark matter. Let's assume that stars somehow form in there that we could observe. And people sort of seized on that to say, well, the fact that we only see a couple dozen dwarfs around the Milky Way, maybe that's because there's really hundreds or thousands of these dark matter clumps, but only some of them have stars in them. That's a reasonable suggestion. We focused on a different prediction that's much harder to explain away in this way, and that is that the simulations, again, predict that these dark matter clumps, these dwarf galaxy halos, should be distributed in a more or less random way around the Milky Way or other galaxies. What you observe is very different. Since the 1970s, it's been known that the dwarf galaxies associated with the Milky Way, almost all of them orbit in a very strange way. They're in a thin disk which goes sort of over the pole of the Milky Way, perpendicular to the disk of the Milky Way itself. In other words, the dwarf galaxies are like a little solar system in that they all orbit in the same direction, in roughly the same plane, around the Milky Way. And no simulation ever produced that sort of structure in terms of the dark matter subhalos, the things that are supposed to be the dwarfs. Recently, last year, it was discovered that the nearest galaxy to ours, the nearest big galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, which also had been known to have dwarf galaxies, although too few, many of those are also in a very similar structure, a thin plane in which the dwarf galaxies orbit in the same sense around.
A long disk, looks almost like a tadpole or...
Depends on what direction you look at it from.
Right, yes,
yeah,
right.
But think of the solar system, the planets going around the sun in the same direction, the same kind of thing. And so in our recent study, we asked how likely or unlikely would it be for two galaxies like the Milky Way and Andromeda to have their dwarf galaxies, most of them, in these planar structures as opposed to the much more random distribution that the simulators had been predicting for years. And we found it was very unlikely. Maybe one chance in a million that you would expect to find such structures around two nearby galaxies. So that was the import of our study. It's just a piece of the bigger puzzle, but it's yet another way in which the standard model of cosmology makes a prediction which isn't verified when you go out and look in detail.
And so again, for those who may claim that we need much, and everybody wants larger sample size of study.
Sure.
But for those who claim that this is in the infant stages and that you need a much larger sample size to have confidence, you accounted for that and said, again, for Andromeda and for the Milky Way to have these similarities, maybe one in a million. So
that's right, yes.
Does that essentially settle your confidence level with it?
No, there's always outs.
Okay.
In the case of the Milky Way, there's always this problem that we're observing from inside of it. We're buried deep inside of the disk of the Milky Way. That's where the sun is. And so there's always difficulties observing the entire sky, because when you look in directions that go through the disk of our galaxy, you have to deal with extinction from dust that's in between the stars. And so it can be difficult to correct for that and to know whether the part of the sky that you can see is typical of the whole sky. I think we put that concern to rest. Aside from that, I don't see many ways out. One could imagine that there's a huge population of unobserved dwarf galaxies, and maybe they have a different distribution, but it's hard to see why.
Dark dwarf galaxies.
That's right. They have to be dark.
I'm sorry about that.
Or very, very low luminosity to have not been observed yet.
But now I would imagine with the work that the team has done on this, that the establishment would take a step back and sort of recalibrate their understanding of the way things are structured. And I don't know how long it's been. I don't know what the feedback you've gotten privately, but is there any sort of movement to embrace this?
Well, I can't speak for the establishment, and I guess I'm not really part of it. I think it's fair to say that scientists like to work on things where they think they can make progress. And this aspect of the universe is one that, as far as I know, there aren't any good ideas to explain. Let me put that differently. If you no longer associate the dwarf galaxies that we see around the Milky Way with these little lumps of dark matter that the simulators predict, then you have to wonder what the connection is between the simulations and the universe. It's almost as if the dark matter isn't there. That's one possible way out. And that's such an extreme conclusion to draw that most people don't want to go there.
Well, and Kyle on Twitter is asking that very question. Fascinating stuff. Does this disprove the notion of dark matter?
There are people who would say that. I wouldn't, but it does make you wonder. Maybe we could talk more about that just in general. Why dark matter, what it would mean to do away with.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I was going to go now in the direction of how do we try to understand whether dark matter exists or not. If it does not, if that is, and again, I don't know if I'm using the correct term, if there is no dark matter, what does that mean going forward? What does that mean for your research and your colleagues and the way we understand the universe?
Well, it's not really clear. There are alternatives, and the one that's most intriguing to dark matter was put forward already in the early days of this field by a guy named Mordechai Milgram. He's a physicist at the Weizmann Institute near Tel Aviv in Israel. And he reasoned as follows. He says, okay, we observe galaxies. There's this rotation curve problem. Stars are moving too fast. What could it mean? And he said, logically, there's two possibilities. One is that there's some extra component of matter, the dark matter, producing extra force. But the other, he said, suppose that there's no dark matter. There's just the matter that we see, and that matter produces the gravity it produces. In that case, you have to imagine that the laws of motion change. Things don't respond to gravity the way that Newton says. And he thought about this for a while and tried to come up with some rule that would reproduce the observations. And he was successful. He said, suppose we imagine that in regions of the universe where the gravitational force is very weak, and we're talking the outskirts of galaxies, that's the only place where the force would be so weak. It's not here. It would be far from galaxies. Suppose that Newton's laws of motion change. And I won't write equations or anything, but his idea was that instead of, you know, force and acceleration being directly related, he put a square root in there. Okay, that very simple rule turns out to work beautifully well, in the sense that every galaxy that's been observed, as far as I know, using Milgram's rule, you can predict how fast the stars are moving everywhere in the galaxy just based on the gravitational force that we know is there, without assuming dark matter. It works much better than the standard model, in the sense that, you know, it doesn't make detailed predictions about how much dark matter any individual galaxy should have. It just makes average predictions. But Milgram's rule works for every galaxy very, very well. No one disputes this. And he made a number of predictions at the time, the early 80s, for things that would be observed, that would be interpreted as dark matter, but he would say that they weren't. And they've all come true.
But David, my son eats Fig Newtons and not Fig Milgrams. Why is Newton a household name and Milgram is a name that most people have never heard of, if this is since the 1980s?
It's a great question. First of all, it's still speculative. The observations that confirm it are not the sort you can do in the laboratory, just because we're in a region where gravitational force is much too strong. I can't really answer your question, but I will say this, that this sort of thing has happened many times in physics, in the sense that people have discovered that some existing theory breaks down in some regime that hadn't been tested before. So, for instance, quantum mechanics only begins to be important on the very small scales, scales of atoms and nuclei. Relativity only rears its interesting head in regions where gravity is very strong. And Milgram's idea was that, well, there's another regime that hasn't been investigated yet. That's sort of the other extreme, the regime of very low gravitational forces. We haven't directly been able to confirm Newton's or Einstein's laws in that regime. The first observations we have that address that issue are the ones I talked about, the rotation curve observations. And they seem to show that matter obeys a different force law than Newton or Einstein would say, which could be dark matter, or he would argue, and others I think as well, it may just be a change in the relation between gravity and motion.
Isn't this the healthiest part of science? Isn't this the continual reassessment of what we think we know? Isn't this the healthiest part of science?
I would say so. In fact, I'd go farther. To me, the most exciting part of the development of any science is, you know, not the early days when things are working out, but the later days when things begin to break down. In the past, when that's happened, it's usually pointed the way toward a new theory. People made observations of atoms that weren't consistent with Maxwell's equations and so forth, and that led to quantum mechanics. People made observations of the solar system that weren't consistent with Newton, and that led to relativity. So everyone knows that existing theories are not complete. There's always some improvement or some better theory. And it's these discrepancies that often in the past have pointed the way toward the new theory. And I think that's how I interpret these observations and Milgram's law. They're an indication that we're missing something. Even if there is dark matter, it has to behave in such a way as to reproduce these funny things that Milgram noticed. So even then, there's a problem. But I think it's more interesting to speculate about whether there maybe just isn't any dark matter.
And let me start to close this half hour on the question of dark matter. There are, as I understand it, David, there are some efforts to at least try to confirm or disconfirm its existence. Lux being a detector in that, from what I'm reading about Lux, it's a large xenon tank whose outer regions shield the interior from gamma rays and neutrons designed to help detect it. So give me a quick snapshot of Lux and what you think about it.
Sure. So Lux is one of the most recent and most sensitive of these detectors' attempts to directly see the dark matter particles.
Where is it?
It's buried in a mine in South Dakota, I believe, far beneath the Earth. And the reason is to shield from things like cosmic rays that should be shielded. Dark matter, by assumption, is so weakly interacting with normal matter that it would travel right through the rock layers. That also makes it hard to catch it in the detector because it tends to pass right through. So this particular detector, LUX, it stands for Large Underground Xenon, I believe. It's a tank of about half a ton of liquefied xenon. It's under high pressure, I guess. I'm not sure. And it's designed so that if a dark matter particle passes through, then occasionally you might get lucky enough that it passes close to a nucleus of xenon and transfers some kinetic energy to it, which can then be observed through their detectors. So it came online last year, and the first results after, I think, 3 months of continuous running were published in August of last year, and they were negative. No detections were made. If they had been, you would certainly have heard of that.
Yes, that would be. And yes, but again, that's valuable in and of itself, isn't it?
It is. And if you read the paper and the press releases that came out at the time, it was kind of presented as a positive result, which I suppose it was, in the sense that certain possible particles were ruled out. Certain properties of these putative particles were ruled out, because if the dark matter had those properties, they would have been observed, and they weren't. So in that sense, it eliminated some large part of the possibilities. And the experiment's still running. Who knows? Maybe it or other ones like it will detect something. But in the last year, I get the sense that people are beginning to worry a bit and to say, well, you know, where will this end? If we never detect the dark matter and we build bigger and bigger detectors, which, of course, are more and more expensive, at what point do we sort of stop and say, you know, maybe we look in some other area?
Milgram?
For instance, yeah.
My guest for this half hour has been David Merritt, a professor of physics and astronomy in RIT's College of Science. Quick snapshot of what is next for you. After all this notion on dwarf galaxies, we'll see again how the establishment, for lack of a better term, as if science is a monolith, responds. But what's next for you on this?
I'm going to move away from this subject for a while and see how the community responds to it. I've got
Very
other projects having to do with the other regime of stronger gravity, which I'd rather work on. There's no dark matter involved. So.
We're going to take a short break, and then there's a man in the studio who probably should have been conducting this interview. Don Feiger's been listening in, and he's much smarter than I am when it comes to these things. And we're going to get his take, not only on what he's heard, but I also can't wait to talk about the Center for Detectors and much more about the ways we look into the cosmos. And Don Feiger is a probably better position to answer that question than maybe anyone. So short break. It's our Science Roundtable. Thrilled to have Don and David in studio with us on this Monday on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, the very latest on Governor Cuomo, ethics reform, and the Moreland Commission. Earlier this year, the legislature did pass an ethics reform package, even though it was almost universally panned as weak. So why is the governor calling it a phenomenal success? And what's next on the legal side, with a federal prosecutor investigating Moreland? It's all coming up next hour.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Former President Nixon taped thousands of hours of conversations when he was in the White House. Now they've been transcribed in a new book.
scholars could actually be a fly on the wall and watch, if you like, the sausage factory of how policy is being made, and in Nixon's case, particularly foreign policy.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. It's our monthly science roundtable, and Don Feiger from the Center for Detectors at RIT is here. And Don is a name that you might have seen on the front page of the New York Times. How many years ago was it now, Don, the discovery of the pistol star?
I think that was 97.
97. So yeah. You not only were above the fold on the front page of the New York Times, but I've seen YouTube clips of you on just about every major news program in the country. And so here you are listening to David. Quick take on what you just heard.
I was interested in what he was saying about the Milgram's factor, the correction to the equations, taking the square root, and wondered if it applied to all the manifestations of dark matter, because that's one of the problems, that when we make a new theory or a new model, sometimes it only addresses a few of the phenomena related to, in this case, dark matter.
Are you comfortable or uncomfortable with some of those notions? Milgram, for example?
I think that I've seen many papers trying to suggest what might be the cause of the phenomena we see that we attribute to dark matter. And it adds to the conversation of people in the field to try to figure out if that can truly explain all the things that we're not understanding. Time will tell. I think it's a great idea, and there are many other ideas, too. For other problems, too, the same thing happens. When we have a gap in our knowledge, people throw out ideas, and it turns out necessarily most of them are wrong because they're different ideas, and it's not, phenomena usually can't be explained with multiple ideas. Usually it's just one idea that comes through.
Yeah, and as Dave and I were saying, we can look at whether it's dark matter, Milgram, Newton, et cetera, and I think the constant examination is so healthy. It's odd that once in a while you hear people say that it would be a weakness if somehow that we move toward Milgram and away from Newton in some way, or if dark matter were somewhat discredited, or however you want to describe it. I wouldn't think that would be a weakness at all. I mean, how do you view that continual scientific advancement, even if there's pushing forward and pulling back a bit and sort of recalibrating our understanding?
I think it's impossible to take that out of science. They'd probably call it something else. It wouldn't be called science. That is an integral part of science. And like I was saying, this happens all the time for multiple puzzles. People throw out all sorts of ideas. And eventually, the one that we think is correct or a better model ultimately has to still account for everything else we understood before with the previous model, like relativity being able to also incorporate what we understood with Newton.
Don Feiger, in 1997, you became a star, is sort of a cheesy word for it, but I mean, you had so many places that you could end up. You've been at RIT for how long now?
Since 2006.
And I know that RIT feels so fortunate to have you there, and you had to make some decisions on what you decided that you wanted to pursue. I want to hear more about, for those who don't know about the Center for Detectors, I want to start there. What is the mission of the Center for Detectors?
Sure. So the Center for Detectors develops new kinds of light detectors, primarily for astrophysics. But in any application where you're trying to push a field to the very limit, it's necessary to build better and better instruments. And that might even be true for medical instrumentation or Earth remote sensing, even military applications where it's important to try to get the best representation of reality, the best possible measurement. So we're developing detectors in collaboration with many different entities, universities, national laboratories, NASA, for instance, NSF. And ultimately, we hope that we end up developing devices that are much more sensitive than what's available now and would then be deployed in future missions, for instance, maybe to detect another planet like Earth that requires better detectors than we have now.
And this is why I want to go back to the pistol star, because my understanding, and again, please stop me whenever I'm wrong, and that will probably be pretty soon. My understanding is that upon the discovery, discovery is the right word, or the detection of the pistol star, it was the most luminous or massive yet discovered. It may still be that way, but the reason that we don't ever see it in the night sky is because much of it's obscured by cosmic dust? And is that sort of an oversimplification? Or if this is the most massive, why are we not seeing it?
No, that's not an oversimplification. That's exactly what it is. If it weren't for the dust, then it would be not a bright star, but it would be maybe similar to the North Star, maybe a little bit fainter. But you would be able to see it with the naked eye.
As far away as it is, which is assumed to be how far?
25,000 light years. So it's at the center of the galaxy. So it's pretty far away, and as a light-emitting object gets further away, it appears to be less bright to us, right? That's true with a candle. It's true with a star, anything that emits light. With the dust that is distributed between our location in the galaxy and the center of the galaxy, it turns out that you can't see the star with the naked eye. But it's worse than that. You can't see it with any telescope in existence, nor with any telescope that is being planned at the present time at optical wavelengths. So at wavelengths where our eyes are sensitive. But at infrared wavelengths, it's relatively easy to detect because infrared wavelengths can penetrate through the dust at a much higher rate than optical photons.
All right, so forgive me. That's what happened, and that's what allowed you to detect it the first time around.
It was the advent of infrared detectors that led to the identification of the Pistol Star as being so massive. And in some sense, once we had the detector, the discovery became easy.
And that's what is so exciting about the Center for Detectors, in that, again, there's many different applications, but if you just think about improving the way we observe the cosmos, to me that's very exciting. My understanding is James Webb doesn't go online till 2018, is that right?
That's correct. We hope it'll be launched in late 2018.
So tell us a little bit about James Webb.
So the James Webb Space Telescope has been in development since probably 97, 98. I worked on it from 99 through 2005 when I was at the Space Telescope Science Institute. That's the organization that operates the Hubble Space Telescope. And we'll have the job of operating the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's a bigger telescope, and just like better detectors, bigger telescopes are more sensitive, so they can see fainter things. So one way to discover new things is to see things you couldn't see before.
You're looking at, you're just sharpening what we're able to detect and see out there.
Seeing smaller things or things that are further away, things that are more deeply embedded in dust. So the James Webb Space Telescope is bigger than the Hubble Space Telescope. And there's a familiar trend also on ground-based telescopes that astronomers want to build bigger and bigger telescopes. So on the ground, there are new telescopes being developed now. And in space, the James Webb Space Telescope will be bigger than Hubble. But there's also an interesting distinction between JWST and Hubble, and that is JWST is more sensitive in the infrared. And so it'll be able to detect light at much longer wavelengths than Hubble. So it will be able to penetrate more deeply into, for instance, the center of the galaxy or into the dust cocoons that surround stars that are being formed.
And I'm hearing about 30-meter telescopes and other things as well that are even, next generation, farther down even past James Webb. Are we looking even beyond James Webb at this point?
Yes, so all those are on the ground. So they're located on some, they will be located on some mountain somewhere.
Okay.
And we generically refer to these as the next generation of extremely large telescopes. I think we're running out of superlatives. but the next big telescopes are said to be extremely large. Okay. And that's because some telescopes that exist now are actually called the Very Large Telescope is one of them, for instance, in the Very Large Array. The TMT is one of them. And there are three being developed. And the TMT, like you said, is the 30-meter telescope, meaning that the mirror or the dish is 30 meters wide or will be 30 meters wide. That's being developed by University of California, Caltech, Canada, China, some other countries, Japan, India. And that is one project that's been in development for quite some time. And I believe they just broke ground recently. And maybe that'll come online in the next 4 or 5 years. It's on the ground in Hawaii on Mauna Kea, 14,000 feet up, where it's nice and dry. So the seeing conditions are very good. There's also the Giant Magellan Telescope, which is smaller and it's 25 meters, and it's composed of seven individual 8-meter mirrors, all strung together in a circle. So there are gaps between the mirrors in that telescope, whereas the 30-meter telescope is going to be composed of hexagonal mirrors where the edges line up and there are no gaps, and it's going to be hundreds of these mirrors. And then the last one is European-based. It's the European Extremely Large Telescope, or the EELT. And at the present time, it's going to be bigger than 30 meters, but it keeps changing. They keep making it smaller. I think it started out as 50 meters. For a while, they were talking about a much larger telescope that would be called OWL, which was the overwhelmingly large telescope. And I think they gave up on that because these extremely large telescopes have extremely large budgets.
Yeah.
Each one's about $1 billion.
Well, and Don, on Twitter, Amanda was asking about why it takes so long, why James Webb could be a 20-year project, for example. You've worked on
these. Yep.
Obviously, you can't build it overnight, but why do some of them take years and years?
Usually the technology doesn't exist when they're first conceived. So for the James Webb Telescope, there are all sorts of technologies that have to come together to make that project work. And at the beginning of the project, the technology doesn't exist. So what do? You try to invent the technology. But to do that, you then have to fabricate what you're trying to make and then do testing and then find out it doesn't work. And so I spent 5 years testing the prototype detectors for the James Webb Space Telescope. And we found that some detectors did what we wanted them to do, and some detectors didn't. They were too noisy, and so it wouldn't have been good to use those.
Define the term noise.
Sure. The easiest way I could explain it, and is relatable to probably everyone, is something that happened to me a week ago at my 4-year-old daughter's birthday party when she was blowing out the candle, and I took a picture, and I saw sort of salt and pepper. It's a very faint scene, right? And so you end up seeing a picture that looks kind of noisy. And it's very difficult to discern maybe the expression on her face or the way her hair's arranged or something like that because it's kind of dark. And you can keep taking pictures under those conditions, and that salt and pepper pattern will appear to move so that different pixels appear to be too bright or too dim. And that's the electronic noise in the detector and in the camera itself that's creating a false signal. Now, imagine that you're trying to find a planet like Earth around a star like the sun that's, you know, 10 or 20 light years away. That planet will be very faint, and the star around which it orbits will be very bright. So it's important to block out the light from the star, but then also it's important to be able to detect the feeble amount of light that's reflected by that planet. And imagine the detector's noisy, and some of the pixels are bright not because there are planets, but because the detector's noisy. So hopefully you won't call up the New York Times and announce that you've just discovered a whole bunch of planets when it's just the detector that's noisy.
Don Figer, my guest on the Science Roundtable, as we talk about RIT's Center for Detectors and the future of detection. Did you have any of that nervousness in 1997 when you were on in the New York Times and they were talking about the pistol star? Because since then, we have heard large announcements with lots of fanfare about this star, and sometimes they turn out to be clusters of stars or sort of
right.
Misdescribed yep. Since then.
Yeah, I knew that could happen at that time, but that's part of science, is to publish the result and then be careful in the paper to explain that there are alternate explanations. It's not just what you're saying has to be the absolute truth, because it's rare that anyone would know that. So we didn't know at the time that it was the most massive star known. And in fact, we didn't say it was definitively the most massive star known. We said that the observations are consistent with the idea that it's one of the most massive stars.
Don, that kind of nuanced, responsible yeah. language doesn't fly in the mainstream media.
It gets lost, I know. Yeah.
But since then, the pistol star has held up as a single entity?
So far, but every now and then someone publishes something that suggests it could be multiple. And I just saw some of this recently where someone saw that it appears that the star is coming toward us and then going away from us in a rhythmic pattern as if there's another component, another star, and the two stars are orbiting each other, right? And so in this way, we're just seeing the light from the brighter star, but there's also another star next to it. That could be. We did some work to try to figure out.
They'd still have to be massive stars, wouldn't they?
For it to alter the mass estimate of the bigger star, the second star has to be pretty massive.
Yeah, I would think.
Right, to change the prediction. We did some work to try to figure out if it was single or not, and found that it was single down to about 100 astronomical units, which is a measure of distance. It's the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So we found that there was no companion outside of that distance, because if there was, we would have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is 100 AU is still big, and it's still possible for there to be a companion inside that space. So it could be multiple. I have a table of all the failures throughout history of claims that there's the most massive star known. Someone would publish that, and then a few years later, someone would find out that there's actually two stars there. And in one famous case, there was a suggestion that there was an object that was 3,000 times the mass of the Sun, and it turned out to be multiple objects. And then later, it turned out to be a massive cluster. of stars, many, many, many.
But again, the open to revision is vital, and that's part of the process. If the pistol star is a single body, compare it to the Sun, how much more massive?
Probably around 120 to 150 times the mass of the Sun, and it produces something like 5 million times the power of the Sun.
Our brains can't wrap around that, but we can try. I think it just reminds us that our Sun is not a large star.
No, it's pretty average. Another way to think about it is if you took the pistol star and then stuck it where the Sun is, then we would be inside of it. So that's how big it would be. It'd be a hot day. So,
we wouldn't have too many hot days.
Yeah.
Don Feiger from the Center for Detectors at RIT looking 25 years and 100 years from now. I mean, no one could possibly understand what kind of technology we'll be able to create, other than to assume that, barring a singularity that's catastrophic or nuclear annihilation, we're going to eventually have detectors that are even much more sensitive and effective than in our lifetimes. What's your expectation? I mean, even if you could guess a generation or two, your children's future and your grandchildren.
Right. Well, they'll probably be able to take better pictures at birthday parties. That's probably true. I think we're at the point now where we're going to have detectors that detect every single photon. And one can't do any better than that to detect the individual elements of light itself, because that's all that's there in the signal. As it is now, the noise in detectors is in excess of the signal generated by individual photons. And we're working on a project now to do that single photon detection. It's needed for some of these projects that are being proposed now. Already this technology is needed. And like I said, with JWST, it took 20 years to develop the technology. And so now we're developing the technology that's going to be on missions maybe in 15 or 20 years, if we're lucky.
And just a couple minutes left here. I think of the work that you do at RIT, and the demands on your time have to be remarkable. How do you decide what kind of focuses, what kind of the ways you want to structure the work of the center and your own work?
Well, one of the things is important to us is that we're always doing something that we think is significant. And for me, that means pushing the edge of what's possible. If it's already been done, or if it already looks like it's easy to do, we wouldn't want to be involved. And so we spend a lot of time pushing on the hardest possible problems. And it's interesting, what that means is we do not succeed every single day. I don't want to say fail, but we have to take, you know, two steps forward, one step back, make some mistakes, and then correct what we're doing, do new designs, do new fabrications. In a couple hours, I'm getting on an airplane to go out to Santa Barbara tomorrow, where I have meetings to meet with some people there who are developing detectors with us that we hope are going to fly in space someday.
Is there a good active source of general funding for the kind of work you're doing to keep it moving at the pace that you want?
It costs a lot to do this,
yeah,
which is unfortunate. So to do a detector fabrication run might cost a few a few hundred thousand dollars. So that's just to try an idea, right? And then it takes a lot of people working on this. So the JWST is a $9 billion project, and it has thousands of people working on it.
It could be another reason why it doesn't happen overnight there, yes.
Yeah, and the detector portion itself was over $50 million. So there is funding for detectors because you can't do without them. It's still difficult for me. We have to write lots of proposals to win the funding, but we've gotten $13 million in the past 7 years at RIT and the Center for Detectors. And so we're getting the funding that we need.
For those of us happy to see someone like you at RIT, are you happy there? Are you going to be there for a while?
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I don't think I could have done this anywhere else because what I'm doing is I'm mixing science and engineering and many of the subfields in science and engineering. And at many other schools, the idea is you're in one department and you're doing one thing, and it's very difficult to spread out and do interdisciplinary stuff. Yeah.
Jump on YouTube and look up Don Figer, the baby-faced Don Figer, back at the discovery of the Pistol Star. He's still sort of a young face.
A few years ago.
Yeah, a few years ago. And now imagine the work that he's doing right here at RIT. Pleasure to talk to you about it, and I hope we have many more conversations about the work that you and the Center are doing.
Thank you.
And David Merritt as well, thank you for taking the time to be here and explain to us everything that your team has been working on in relation to dwarf galaxies and more. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
It's been a fascinating science roundtable. We're going to post a link on our Twitter page and on WXXI Online so you can read more about the work that David's team's doing, and you can check out the Center for Detectors at RIT. Short break, and Cuomo Moreland at our next hour. Stay with us.